We begin the second hour of the show by getting on board the telephone line and welcoming in our friend, writer, and critic, Colin Fleming. Hello there, Mr. Fleming.
Hey, how's it going, Mr. Kimball?
Outstanding. How are you this fine day?
Well, even by my standards, I'm getting kicked in the teeth pretty hard today, but we are here to talk about some Orson Welles, yes?
Yes, indeed. Who would have thought that more than 30 years after his death, an Orson Welles movie would be one of the most talked about films of the year? But The Other Side of the Wind, I can't think of enough good things to say about it. It's just so different than anything else that's out there.
Very different. I think sometimes when something like this comes along, though, people do have a tendency to want to sort of overlay the praise on it, and it's tempting, right, to want to confer upon it this notion of masterpiece status. And it's ironic, of course, that Welles, who was hated by the Hollywood system, so much so that he was basically driven out of the country and had to live as a kind of art-making radical in absentia, had to self-finance his films, and now this is as mainstream as you get, right? Netflix, big, mighty conglomerate Netflix type of thing, and I can imagine Welles would have, well, beyond thinking it ironic, he probably would have been horrified by it. And there's a degree of hypocrisy with it, that now it's this guy, oh, let's have Orson Welles trending, and Orson Welles' face on the side of buses. And it's a shame that it had to come 40 years later for this guy who, frankly, was better at making movies than anyone else.
Well, as the documentary says, they'll love me when I'm dead. And certainly there seems to be a level of appreciation for his work now that exceeds what it was certainly during that period in the 60s and 70s when he was struggling to get films made and financed.
That's apocryphal. He never said that. And it's funny, though, that he was always well-regarded, especially by people in Europe. He was always considered like the big honcho of filmmakers. People like Godard would praise films that even now haven't caught on with Wellesians like Mr. Arcaden. He was definitely outside the system, and he's having this renaissance. And, you know, I would say to people, though, that if you're on the Netflix and you're watching this, you also want to make sure to double back and check out films that, even in Welles' lifetime, were overlooked. And some of them, there's a lot more than Citizen Kane. Some of them, something like Falstaff or Chimes at Midnight film. I don't know how you make a better film than that. I've watched it several times this week because the documentary and The Other Side of the Wind sort of drove me back to that, with this notion of betrayal, which was central to Welles' work, and he was betrayed by a system, and people have come along now, these volunteers in service of Orson Welles, as they would call themselves, and they've put this out there. It almost reminds me, do you know who Dean Benedetti is? Benedetti is?
I do not.
Jazz guy who, he would basically follow around Charlie Parker, and he had the tape recorder, and he would bootleg these Charlie Parker sax solos. And he wouldn't really record like the rest of the band sometimes. He just wanted to get to Charlie Parker. The Other Side of the Wind and the way it was made is this composite. It sort of puts me in mind of that, where it's basically like bootlegged Welles, these bits and pieces that people have stuck together that might not be the same thing as what he intended as a cohesive film.
Do you put any stock in the theory, and it's floated a little bit in the documentary, that Welles never really wanted to finish Other Side of the Wind and had trouble wrapping up any of his films?
No, I don't. I think that's the biggest fallacy there is with Orson Welles. This guy did things that were so beneath him. Granted, he was like paid a lot of money, but if you go and you look through like the films he acted in, he played Ben Franklin twice. And like, not a knock on Franklin, but he would slum it unbelievably. So you can go watch him like horror films from the early 1970s. He had enough money to live off of. This was all so he could put it back into his films. Why would anyone debase themselves like that? I mean, really, go on YouTube and watch some of them. They're like Ed Wood type schlock. In the out comes Orson Welles. Why would someone do something like that to fight for like 3, 4, 5 years to complete a film? Look how long he worked on Othello. When this reputation sort of came to him, it was when he was in Brazil and he was shooting a documentary. The United States government ordered him to go there and do this while it was like post-production work on Magnificent Ambersen. So he's like frantically like cabling back to Hollywood about like, what are you doing to my film? And he got this reputation as someone who split town basically to indulge himself. The guy literally died while writing a script, like Elvis on his throne, but Orson Welles at his desk, for a film that almost surely was never going to be made. This man existed and did everything humanly possible to finish films. And if he didn't finish The Other Side of the Wind, which of course he didn't, it's because he also was working on so many other things at the same time. That's the nature of the situation that he was put into by a corrupt, bigoted system.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Well, Other Side of the Wind stands apart from everything that's out there today, but as you look at it in the full complement of Welles films, where does it belong in that list of great Orson Welles movies? Or does it belong there at all since he really didn't finish it?
It's that notion again, I think, of like the studio outtake. Like you have your sort of proper canon by a band, and then you have an assemblage of outtakes. And can it sort of radiate a spirit unto itself that reaches you, that makes it work almost despite itself? Yes. And I think The Other Side of the Wind does that. But it doesn't cohere like Chimes of Midnight does. It doesn't even really have Welles's full inflection, as I would think of it, like Ambersen does. Ambersen's is like 80% Welles, and then it's slashed. We don't really know what percentage of this is Welles. These people had to do yeoman's effort to put this together. But if you watch just the notion of a visual signature, you can watch 10 frames of this film, and you know it's Orson Welles. But you can also do that with The Trial. You can do that with anything he ever did. It's that sort of collage aspect, though, where it's 35 millimeter, it's black and white, it's color, it's cinema verite, it's depth of field and precision camera work, and he's clearly the one who is orchestrating all the shots. And he's basically using Gary Graver as a lackey, which I wonder, when I think about Graver's devotion to Welles, it's obviously Welles is the one who's setting up everything with the cameras and just basically saying, okay, run this. Now I'm going over here. So it's a fascinating sort of kind of collage experiment, but I wouldn't say it coheres with the kind of specificity of vision that his best films do.
What did you think of a Morgan Neville's Netflix companion piece, the documentary?
Didn't think much of it. I thought if someone had read very much about Welles at all, there was nothing new. I didn't care for the cutie-oochie kind of drop-ins you do with the sound where you come to the end of the line and then someone else, Welles or Bogdanovich, finishes the line. I think Welles would have been aghast by that. Not that you're trying to placate a deceased artist notion of their aesthetics when you make a documentary, but I didn't think it worked very well. I thought actually the better documentary was the shorter one. I don't think a lot of people have seen. It's also part of this package where it's like 40 minutes long,
right?
And it's about what went into making this project complete as best as it could be completed. And that, where they're talking about the artificial intelligence used and everything, I thought was really interesting because it's almost like Welles was grappling with technology in a sense when he made this. Sometimes when you're a genius and it's easy for you to figure things out, as it was for Welles, it can be very liberating to struggle. Does that make sense? Because you don't normally struggle. So when you have to sort of find your paces along that flagstone path through a work of art, and you're making a new kind of art, basically, within your medium, just what this film is. Whatever you want to think about how effective it is a completely new cinematic vocabulary. And I think Welles was, in a sense, trusting that process, that it was going to take as long as it took. And they ran out of money, and then they had to do other things, and you've seen the wine commercials and all that, and he died in 85. You probably thought he was going to come back to it. And when he died, we think of him because he was so large, but he was only 70 years old when he died. I mean, look at, like, John Huston in the film. He doesn't die until, like, what, 1987? He looks like he's not going to last another friend in the film. Like, he looks as old as you can look.
Colin Fleming, you can read all of his work at colinfleminglit.com. And don't be like me. Why did I not subscribe to your blog until you gave me a reminder the other day? The Many Moments More blog is fantastic.
Oh, thank you. Well, got the heartening news from the webmaster today about Google Analytics, and saw that a robust 30 people in the bloody world visited the site in October. So I don't think anyone is seeing that blog, but maybe another four of you can hop on over there, and that'd be great.
You should do it. It's like getting a gift of awesomeness every time you open your email, and there it is from Colin. We thank you, as always, my friend, and we'll do it again next week.
Okay, sounds good.
And it's Colin Fleming here on Downtown.